or artswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Are you ever listening to a new pop song or reminiscing over an old, well-loved album? And you catch a melody or a lick that reminds you of a different album altogether? Next thing you know, you're reading about the profound influence of synthesizers on rock and roll? Well then join me, Katie Zip, for Double Groove, a genre-bending show where we'll take a deep dive into an album, exploring the influences, history, and take a few quirky turns, all for maximum enjoyment and understanding of the music we love. Every second Friday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m., it's Double Groove with Katie Zip, only on your community radio station, KBOO on 90.7 FM.
Into a crisis of times when I'm lying in bed, just to get it all out, what's in my head, and I am feeling a little peculiar. And so I wake in the morning and I step outside and I take a deep breath and I get real high and I scream from the top of my lungs, what's
Hello, you're listening to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're going to be talking with Brenda Lopez. Brenda Lopez is a Chicana organizer and a graphic designer turned activist based in Los Angeles, co-founder of the U.S. Hands-Off Cuba Committee, who after a life-changing visit to Cuba in 2019 has been building youth, immigrant, and labor solidarity campaigns between the U.S. and Cuba. Brenda, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Emma, for having me.
Thanks so much. So, Brenda, can you tell me, let's start with this. Can you start by telling us a little bit about your background and how you first became involved in activism around Cuba and U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm Chicana, first-generation Mexican-American, was raised in Los Angeles. And I grew up watching Telemundo news on TV with my parents, and all I knew about Cuba was the negative rhetoric that I heard on there. I didn't believe it, but I didn't know anything contrary to it. And then in 2019, a mentor of mine who was my high school teacher, a marine biology teacher, in fact, invited me to go to Cuba while I was doing graphic design work at a newspaper down in San Pedro called Random Lengths News. And he invited me for an environmental conference. And at first I was like, I have nothing to offer to an environmental conference. I'm a graphic designer. And he's like, well, you know about all the pollution that the port causes in those areas. You can talk about that. So I was like, okay, I do know about that. I'll talk about that. And so that's how I ended up going to Cuba for the first time in 2019. And then just being there was mind-blowing and mind-changing, as you mentioned, for me to see just an alternative system in practice and to see how, you know, an economic system not only impacts the way we relate to money, but the way we relate to each other, the way we relate to the world. And that had a really big impact on me.
What does the slogan U.S. Hands Off Cuba mean to you personally?
To me, it means letting Cuba have autonomy and sovereignty to carry out however it means to carry out without having American influence or input, which, as we've seen, that America does in all of Latin America, in Mexico, in Venezuela, how we're seeing now. So to me, it just means making sure that the Cuban people are able to carry out their government and their system as they would like to, with no American influence.
Were there specific experiences in your life or in your community that shaped your commitment to solidarity with the people of Cuba?
I would say, like, in my immediate life, just seeing what America has done to Latin America and learning from that from my parents, you know, like, I feel a lot of the reasons people immigrate from their countries is not because they want to, but because they need to. And then once you start looking at the underlying reasons of why they had to do that, a lot of the times it has to do with U.S. companies that go and extract natural resources and leave crippling economies that they pay little money, very little money to the people who live there and just pollute the land. And so I feel like stemming out of that and seeing a system that is contrary to that is what called me to, like, do Cuba solidarity work, because I think we all have a lot to gain, not just Americans, not just Latin Americans, but the whole world has a lot to gain from Cuba's example on the way they take preventative measures and almost everything, and climate change and health and education. And I think it's a inspiration for all of us.
How has being Latinx affected the way that you approach organizing and international solidarity work?
Well, I think for me, it's just, like I said, it's given me a worldview outside of the U.S. It's very easy to be in a bubble here and focus on our problems, but not focus on the impacts that our lifestyles here have on the rest of the world. And not just going to Cuba, but even if you go to Latin America, if you start asking questions and talking, really having conversations and engaging with people, you realize that a lot of their issues stem from capitalism and imperialism, whether it be from the US or Europe or, you know, colonization back in the day. And we still see the repercussions of all of that nowadays. And so I think because of that, being Latinx, those things were very clear to me coming from a household where I was the first one in this whole different system and the whole different world, which my parents said they came here, you know, for better opportunities. But as you probably know, those opportunities are diminishing day by day here. And what the so-called American dream is just a dream, really.
How would you describe the current state of U.S.-Cuba relations, especially under the current administration?
Yeah, so I would say they're pretty awful right now. It's hard to have hope under the Trump regime, because since his very first time in office and his last time he was president, he was the one who put Cuba back on the state sponsors of terrorism list and added like 200 sanctions, some of which, I mean, just this past February, he ended all visas for Cubans. And so I can only see those threats increasing under Trump. And as we know, like, Obama had removed Cuba from the state sponsor of terrorism list, and it helped the economy flourish and people were happy. And that doesn't mean he removed all the sanctions, but even, you know, just removing them off of that list had a huge positive impact in Cuba. And Biden promised that he would remove Cuba from that list, and he did, but he only did it 4 days before leaving office, which he knew very well Trump would reinstate him. And yeah, that's like one of the first things he did when he went back into office. So I can only see things getting harder. Biggest misconception is that people think like, oh, well, look, they have such a bad economy, it's because of the economic system that they chose to have, when in reality, it's like, well, if you look at it, that economic system has been has had the boot to the neck since the very beginning. So how can it actually ever accomplish? Well, even then, it has accomplished a lot of what it wanted to accomplish, regardless of all these sanctions. And I think that has to say a lot. Once I started talking to people, especially now, the things that we're fighting for, like, you know, education, free education, universal health care for all. It's like, this is things that Cuba has been offering its people for 66 years, even with a very suffocated economy. And so when I start questioning people about that, they're like, and so I asked them, like, so how is it that the richest country in the world can't provide those basic needs for people? Then they're like, oh. And the other thing I noticed, there's a lot of propaganda, and the U.S. spends millions of dollars in anti-Cuba propaganda that it works, you know, because I'll talk to people and I'll mention Cuba and they start saying like all this negative rhetoric propaganda that they hear. And then I will ask them like, well, have you actually like been to Cuba? And then they say no, and then I start talking to them, they're like, oh, and they're like oh yeah, like that's just what I heard on the TV or whatever. So I mean, the U.S. does all of this with reason, because they see Cuba as a threat, you know, as an example for a lot of the things that, especially now under Trump and him removing even more of those just like, you know, basic human rights we're fighting for. And that's why I think Cuba is such a great example for us and a threat to the U.S.
I mean, 66 years is just, that's almost as long as Israel has been suppressing the Palestinians. It's, can you talk, do you see any connection between U.S. policy towards Cuba and Israel's treatment of the Palestinian people?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a direct link. And even if you go to Cuba, there's a lot of Palestinian students at ELAM, which is the international medical school in Cuba. And I mean, Cuba since day one has stood with Palestine, because they see themselves under the same boot, you know, the American boot. I mean, in Palestine's case, it's Israel, but who funds Israel? It's the United States, you know? So in that sense, they see themselves having the same enemy, and just like having all these inhumane sanctions, limitness to their mobilities, you know, them not being able to leave their countries, them not being able to get very basic needs to survive, them not being able to have even diplomatic or academic relationships with a lot of rest of the world, and definitely not the United States. So yeah, I think in many regards, Cuba and Palestine are very similar.
What kind of organizing work is happening right now in the U.S. to push for normalization and to end the blockade on Cuba?
Yeah, so, I mean, since we founded the committee in 2019 in L.A., I feel like there's only been an increase in committees all over the United States, because one of our biggest things is taking people to Cuba. So like I said, so they could see this reality for themselves. They can see how, you know, the economic situations and sanctions create. But regardless of that, so they can see an alternative system where people are proud of the system that they fought for, you know, back in the revolution, and what it has provided for them, and what they see we don't have. I mean, even going to Cuba is myth busting, because I'll start talking to Cubans, and then, you know, and they watch TV, they see American stuff, and so then they think that we all live in mansions and we all have like just everything at our hands. But then I start telling them like, oh no, like I'm in debt because I went to university, and I can probably never afford a home, at least not in the state where I was raised and born and currently live in. And then they're like, what? Like, those things are unfathomable to them. And then they start questioning things too, like, Because, I mean, we also got to put it this way, 66 years in sanctions and them hearing the same thing from the government, like, it's the U.S.'s fault. Like, of course, it's going to start sounding like a bogus answer when you continuously get met with the same answer, like, oh, it's their fault. It's their fault, you know? But that's why I think it's so important to go to Cuba and kind of break myths. You get to break myths on both sides. Like, I understand your situation is not perfect, but at the end of the day, a lot of those issues are not because of your government. It actually is because of the U.S. government.
Despite enormous pressure, Cuba has maintained universal health care, education, and solidarity. What can we in the United States learn from that?
Oh, we have so much to learn from the Cuban people. I mean, first of all, they have a very humanitarian, and when I say humanitarian, it doesn't just expand to them within the island. It expands like internationally. Like I already mentioned to you, Elam, the medical school there in Cuba was created and started by Fidel Castro in order to provide medical training for people that come from low-income countries and low-income areas, and that includes Americans. So there's plenty of Americans. I believe there's like 60 of them this year out there that go and get trained and in Cuba for very little or free, depending what country they're coming from. And their only caveat is they have to come back and practice in low-income resourced areas. And so I think, you know, that approach is a perfect example of just how Cuba approaches almost anything. I mean, for when it comes to the environment, they have an 100-year plan called Tarea Vida, which translates to life homework, which just shows like their priority is life, is humans, it's people, not profit, like we see under capitalism. And so a perfect example is recently they had Hurricane Melissa. And while in Jamaica, they had hundreds of deaths, there was zero deaths in Cuba. And that's because they have part of Tarea Vida, the plan that I just mentioned. There's another little part in there called Proyecto Meteoro, which they do a two-day training for all people that is mandatory, where they learn just preventative ways to protect themselves during hurricanes. So they'll assign shelters, safe places for people that if they know like they'll be in the path of the hurricane. They'll move all the furniture out of their homes if they know that their house is in a risk of being flooded. And I mentioned this because that's exactly because of the sanctions. They know that materially, like those things cannot just be replaced like they would be here in the U.S. Like getting a full new set of furniture for everybody would be basically impossible with the way the sanctions work. And so they make sure that even people's material stuff is kept safe so that when the hurricane is over, they can move their stuff back and they have all their furniture and stuff. So just like that, those preventative measures that save lives and save money, you know, because at the end of the day, the money that they will spend to help recuperate is going to be much less with those preventative measures. And so I think, I mean, climate change is something that affects the whole world, not just Cuba. And so I think in that aspect, we have a lot to learn. Even with the crippling sanctions, they've been able to have so many medical advances. Like I mentioned, during COVID, they had 5 vaccines, which have proven to be much more effective than our vaccines, because since there's vaccines, there have been zero COVID deaths in Cuba. Recently, when I went to Cuba, I saw a movie screening by Belly of the Beast where they're releasing a new documentary about Alzheimer's. And so they have this new Alzheimer's medication that slows down the effects of people losing their memory and stuff. They have a vaccine for lung cancer. They have a vaccine to not amputate diabetic foot, you know, and that's something that still happens in the U.S. Thousands of people have their feet amputated because they have diabetic ulcers here in the U.S., while there's literally already something to avoid that. And the only reason we don't have access to that is because of these sanctions and basically like political and economic warfare that the U.S. has, like I mentioned, put on Cuba for 66 years now. So not only does Cuba lose lives and money, but so do we as Americans. We lose lives and we lose limbs and we lose money because of these bad relations.
Yeah, you mentioned Belly of the Beast. I've seen some of their media. Can you tell me about Belly of the Beast? What is that about?
Yeah, so Belly of the Beast has a very special place in my heart. Like I mentioned, I'm a graphic designer, and I actually was working with them for a little while, doing some graphic design work with them. And now I don't work directly, but I still work indirectly in the way that they follow a lot of the campaigns that we're doing. So recently, I should say yesterday, not even recently, they released a video that they recorded with us on this past visit in October to Cuba, where we're launching a campaign to pressure the Olympic Committee, to pressure the U.S. government to allow Cuban athletes to get visas to come to and qualify for the pre-Olympics to then come to the Olympics. As we know, they're happening in 2028 in Los Angeles. And as of now, the U.S. has denied all the visas that have been applied for Cuban athletes. And so that's our next campaign. And Belly of the Beast just released a video about that yesterday. But specifically, Belly of the Beast has a special place in my heart, especially in the Cuba solidarity work, to introduce people to what's actually happening, what the sanctions mean, because they are Cuban-based journalists. So it's not journalists that are in the U.S. They are Cuba-based and they live in Cuba, and they cover all aspects of Cuba and just try to really get people comfortable with the nuance and the context of like what these sanctions actually mean. And I believe that they do it in a very like apolitical way, even though obviously it's a very political subject because it's our government causing all this stuff. But yeah, I think they do an amazing job at really giving giving an apolitical view to a very complex issue and doing it in a simple manner that like everyday people can understand without having to read like thousands of books or watch thousands of documentaries. So that's Belly of the Beast.
Thank you. When people, like, if you're ever talking to people who have a different opinion from you, like, what do you tell them when they say something like, you know, Cuba needs reform, or, you know, Cuba has to abandon socialism, or, you know, Cuba has to change? What do you tell people when they say Cuba needs reform without acknowledging the way U.S. interference shapes its reality?
Right. Well, I mentioned to them what I mentioned to you. I was like, there has not been 1 year since the Cuban Revolution that Cuba has not been sanctioned. So how are we going to say that socialism doesn't work if we've been interfering since day one? And going back to Belly of the Beast, my favorite video is their very first one from the series War on Cuba, where Liz, who's the narrator of a lot of their videos and now a dear friend, ends the video by saying, like, if, you know, socialism doesn't work, why don't they remove the sanctions? And it's true, because then once you start questioning that, it's like, you know, like, everything is done with a purpose, and the purpose in this regard for the U.S. to still have these sanctions on Cuba is because it sees it as a direct threat. And that's why they also make it really hard for it's not actually hard, but they make it scary, or they make it seem like it's difficult for people to go to Cuba so that people don't go and have, you know, these conversations and these interactions and start questioning things between each other and being like, hold up, like, things aren't adding up here. Like, why is my government hiding from me a place that they create the situation? But even then, like I mentioned, they're able to provide these very basic needs that we've been fighting for years, because obviously stuff is getting worse now, but universal healthcare, free education, housing for all is not topics that were born, you know, in this century. This is stuff that people have been pressuring and talking about since the 60s, since the 70s, you know? And that's when the Cuban Revolution was born. And that's why I think like Cuba is a perfect example of everything the U.S. does not want to provide for its people because of this small island with a suffocated economy can do it. Why can't we? And if people start questioning that, which we already are, you know, without even most of us knowing about Cuba, like that's a big threat to the United States.
So as we're finishing up our interview, can you tell me what do you love about Cuba?
Well, besides how I mentioned their preventative measures when it comes to education, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to health, I also just love the culture. And that's something that is very visible and is very, very beautiful and very big, because that's something that their system also values. And that's something that our system does not value. And that's why a lot of us, I mean, I also do social work, I do mental health counseling and graphic design, a lot of art stuff, you know, is very undervalued in our system, because it doesn't bring profit to big companies or people who already have a ton of money. And that's not the case in Cuba. They invest in this stuff. So that's like, my favorite thing about Cuba is the Cuban people, because there's just this aliveness about them. And so many of them are so well educated, and so many of them are like amazing artists, but then will be like also scientists, you know, so that you just have like these overall super well-rounded people who just see the value and interconnectedness of everything, which I feel here we like our system makes people very individualistic, very isolated, and very
you said it pretty good.
Yeah, like, you know, like we like focus on very individual things. And so, yeah, that's what I love most about Cuba is the Cuban people and their humanitarian view towards the world and the people around them. And that includes, you know, just being in community. Like, even though they have very little, they're willing to share it. Even with someone like me who has access to, you know, a lot more things, like they don't care because they're educated enough to know like, oh, it's not the American people, it's the American government. And I think like that in itself to me since the first time was very eye-opening, that they were educated enough to see that and to know that and still like, you know, welcome Americans with open arms, regardless of what our government does to them. And I think that's something very beautiful.
We've been talking today with Brenda Lopez. Brenda, if people want to get involved in the U.S. Hands Off Cuba campaign, how can they get involved?
Yeah, so you can follow us on U.S. Hands Off Cuba Committee on Instagram. That's where we post most of our updates and stuff. We still have not posted something about the campaign besides the Valley of the Beast video that they did for us about the Olympic campaign, but we're going to start posting some stuff soon on how people can get involved, and that's going to be an international effort. Beyond that, because I mentioned they did just have a hurricane, and there is donations happening, fundraising happening for that, and us specifically, the LAUS Hands Off Cuba Committee partnered with the Pan American Medical Association, which is led by an ULAM student, and not just tourists, to collect money for oral rehydration salts, water purification tablets, and painkillers and antibiotics. And people can also donate to that if they want to get involved in something like much more specific and immediate. But yeah, in the long run, I think, like I mentioned, under Trump, the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. is very, very strained. And so I think having as much support and people just talking about Cuba is really important, because like I mentioned, the sanctions don't just affect Cubans, they affect us. And we also have a lot to gain from bettering relationships with Cuba.
Well, thanks, Brenda. Thanks so much for talking to us while you're here in Portland, and have a good day.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate your questions and taking the time to talk to me.
Great, thanks.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi, I'm Lillian, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate and James share what makes the hobby so vibrant through banter and interviews with local members of the hobby game scene. And if we can inspire a few listeners to join us around the table, all the better. More people to play with. Winner's Bias. You don't have to win to have fun, but it doesn't hurt. The first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Produced at the studios of